Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ask Margot Today. Thank you for joining me while we explore some of the sticky matters of life, things that keep us feeling small or sick or stuck. We welcome your questions and invite you to send them in for solutions that you may not yet have thought of or tried. If you've never tuned into Ask Margot before, what we focus on here is the three areas of our mind, the subconscious and the power we have to direct our lives from that point of view, the conscious and the power we have to speak better things into our lives, and the superconscious, which is about our real potential and how this dance of life is designed to work for us. That's a big intro to what I was trying to say. The word I want to use now is psychoneuroimmunology. This is a discipline that studies how the brain, the nervous system, and the immune system communicate with each other. What is shown is that mental states influence immune activity throughout very real biological pathways. Our bodies don't just react to physical events, they react to perceived reality, which is why chronic stress, long-term rumination, do you get that one? That's when you chew over something repeatedly, and sustained negative expectation have measurable biological effects. They're not just emotional experiences, they are psychological and physiological instructions. The opposite is also true. Positive expectation, perceived safety, and mental focus can influence the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the branch responsible for the parasympathetic nervous system, the branch responsible for restoration, repair, and recovery. When this system is active, heart rate lowers, inflammation reduces, digestion improves, and immune function strengthens. This means our bodies shift into a state that supports healing. Another area of research supporting this is neuroplasticity. I'm telling you about all this because the pursuit of health is really a major part of my work. For many years, scientists have believed the brain was largely fixed after childhood. We now know that the brain constantly rewires itself in response to repeated thinking and behavior. Do you hear what that means? It means whatever you are thinking repeatedly is affecting you physically. This is so important. It's such a revelation if you've never heard that before. You are influencing your body every day by the way you think and speak. Neural pathways strengthen through repetition. The thoughts you rehearse frequently becomes the thoughts your brain becomes efficient at producing. Over time, these patterns shape emotional responses, behavioral habits, and physiological signaling throughout the body. This connects closely with findings in epigenetics, which demonstrate that gene expression is not fixed. Genes can be switched on or off depending on environmental signals. These signals include nutrition, toxins, stress levels, emotional environment, and behavioral patterns. Our bodies are responsive. They constantly adjust in response to the signals they receive. This raises an important question. Where do many of those signals originate? Of course, they come from the brain. The brain is heavily influenced by belief, language, and expectation. This is quite long-winded, isn't it? But it's so important. And I like to sort of introduce myself and where I'm coming from. And this is a very strong part of what my work is about and what this show covers. When someone repeatedly declares that their body is fragile, broken, or failing, the nervous system reorganizes around that threat. The stress response activates more frequently. recovery systems activate less efficiency, behavior becomes more protective and limited, the system stabilizes around the expectation of decline. But when a person offers a different orientation, one of capability, restoration, and direction, the signals change, behavior changes, stress response reduces, and we're all so concerned with stress. Recovery systems activate more easily. This is not motivational thinking, it's actually biological signaling. The body is not a passive machine, it's an adaptive system that listens continuously to the brain. And the brain listens continuously to the story a person repeats about themselves. This doesn't mean that illness is always to be resolved instantly or that medical conditions should be ignored. It just means what we are thinking needs to be our first question. So that's the platform I come from. And I sum it up and run this phrase all the time, which is, you are the genie. You have the power, the right, and are designed to grant your own wishes. I say to people, remember, your genie is listening. You could say that your genie is your subconscious mind, and that's directing everything. Right, on to our questions for today. The first one is from Julie. She says, Margot, what do you do when you feel completely stuck? When you keep saying, I just can't do that, and it feels absolutely true. That phrase, Julie, I can't, is one of the most limiting statements we make. And the reason it's so powerful is because it feels final. It doesn't feel like an opinion, it feels like a fact. I can't leave this relationship. I can't change my career. I can't get on top of my health. I can't speak up. It closes the door before we've even looked at what might be on the other side. Now, there's a very effective way to work with this, and it's so beautifully simple. Try this. When someone says, I can't, instead of arguing with them, instead of saying, of course you can, you go with them for a moment, get alongside them, you acknowledge it. I know, you say to them, because to them, it's true. But then you ask a follow-up question. But if you could, what would you do? That question is so powerful because it does something very interesting. It steps around the block of I can't without trying to smash through it. The mind relaxes slightly because it's no longer being challenged directly. You're not forcing change. You are inviting imagination. And imagination is the doorway. When someone answers that question, even hypothetically, they begin to access a part of themselves that's not constrained by the I can't. Well, if I could, I would leave. If I could, I would start that business. If I could, I would say no. Now we have movement. From a mind and body perspective, this matters. When you're stuck in I can't, it's a closed position. When you ask, if I could, the system opens slightly. The brain shifts from threat mode to possibility mode. The prefrontal cortex, the part responsible for problem solving and imagination, becomes more active. You move from shutdown to exploration. And that's a really different state. It feels different. And the results you get always come from the state you are projecting. Let's go one step further. I can't is rarely a statement of fact. It's usually a statement of identity. It means, I don't believe I'm the kind of person who can do that. Or I'm afraid of what would happen if I did. Or I've not yet found a way. But when you introduce, if I could, you create a bridge between where you are and where you might be. You're no longer trapped inside the identity. You are stepping just beyond it. And once you can see beyond it, even for a moment, the situation is no longer absolute. It becomes negotiable. Now, I'm not suggesting that every problem disappears instantly, but I am suggesting that the moment you can imagine a different response, you've already loosened the grip of the block. So the next time you hear yourself say, "I can't," pause. Acknowledge it if you need to. Say, "I know. But Julie, what if you could?" But if I could, what would I do? Let the answer come without judgment, because that answer is often direction, and it is the first step out of being stuck. So I hope that helps, Julie. Our next question is, what do you say to someone who has had a very difficult past, trauma, hardship, things that were done to them or happened to them, and they still feel the effects of that in their life now, much later? They want something different, but they don't know how to move beyond it. I spoke to a young woman recently who described pretty much exactly that to me. She had experienced a series of very difficult things, physical accidents, abuse, lack, and she could clearly see how those experiences were still shaping her life, her thinking, her reactions, her expectations. And what she said to me was, "I just want something different." So that desire is the starting point. That's important because it means she's no longer fully identified with the past. She can see that it has not been what she wants to continue. I gave her a very simple image. I love this one and I've used it for myself. I said, imagine your past as an old overcoat. You know the kind I mean, a big, heavy grandpa kind of coat, slightly damp, slightly smelly, one that absolutely weighs you down. It doesn't fit you properly. It doesn't make you feel good. It doesn't look good. Perhaps you've been wearing that coat for a long time. It was put on you. This is a metaphorical coat, you understand. You didn't choose it. It came from circumstances, from other people, from events that were outside your control, events in your past. But here's the key. Just because that coat was put on you in the past does not mean you are required to keep wearing it into your future. I asked her to imagine this. You're standing there and you simply let that coat fall off your shoulders. You don't fight it. You don't analyze it, you don't carry it neatly folded over your arm or drag it behind you. You let it drop and then you step forward, away from it. You walk away from it. That's not denial. That's not pretending those things did not happen. It's choosing not to carry them into your future as your identity. Then I suggest one more step. If you're no longer wearing that coat, what would you prefer to wear? What's the coat you would choose? Perhaps it's light. Perhaps it's beautifully made of some gorgeous fabric. Perhaps it fits you perfectly in a colour that lifts you the moment you put it on. Now, instead of wearing what was given to you, you consciously step into what you choose. You put that coat on. That becomes your new experience of yourself. That's how you see yourself now. Now let's understand what's happening here. The mind and the body respond to identity. If you continue to think of yourself as the person who these things happen to, your subconscious organizes itself around that story. You are creating a blueprint for yourself and you're reinforcing and identifying what you no longer want. You're in a pattern of protection, vigilance, and contraction. But when you begin to shift your identity, even symbolically, the system begins to respond differently, your system. You move from reaction to choice. And at a deeper level, this is about authorship. You're not responsible for everything that's happened to you, but you are responsible for what you carry forward. No one else can take that coat off for you. No one else can choose the new one. That's your role. That's where your power sits. You are not here to be permanently defined by your past. You are here to decide who you are now. So if you find yourself weighed down by what has been, ask yourself, am I still wearing something I no longer want? And if the answer is yes, then intentionally and deliberately take it off. Leave it where it belongs and step forward into something you have chosen. Because you are not the coat. You are the one who decides what to wear. It's very important that I say something else here because I've seen it with my clients who have come to a point where they clearly identify what it was in their past that's affected them profoundly and in an ongoing way. They know what it was caused by. They understand that it's not who they are now and that the lack, which is usually what it's about, their unmet need at that time, was not their fault. What I often see is that the next step is absolutely a choice that they have to make and they have to stick with it. I see people revisiting all the time, turning back, looking back, reminding themselves, remembering, seeing where they've come from, who they were before this day. And you can't do that. You must say no more. And you must put a stake in the ground, draw a line in the sand. I know this sounds demanding, maybe harsh even, but it's tough personal love. You have to stop indulging yourself in that language and that thinking, because if you don't, you will not break free. I see people unhappy, living with this stuff for decades. They know it came from a lack of something way back when, and that profound unmet need they had. Acknowledge it, but hold yourself to change. The change that only you can make and only you can decide for yourself. Doesn't matter who you talk to or how much help outside of yourself you seek, it's only you who can change it. Understand that if you do not do that, if you're not prepared to say, that's it, I'm not going to talk about that or go there anymore because it's no longer who I am, then you will stay in that horrible little loop that keeps you trapped, constrained, and small. How can you fulfill your fabulous life with those kinds of shackles? I'm not saying don't go back and sort it, because that's really important to know that you have come to terms with it, understand it, and can let it go. You might say, well, that's too hard. But the point is, if we tiptoe around this, if we fluff it up and make space for it, then you really concede to it. You're bowing to it, and you're allowing it to dominate you and make itself the boss in your life, the determiner. If something or someone did something to you earlier, are you going to give them more power than they've already taken? No. Why would you do that? Every moment is a new moment, and your decision that you make for yourself today will dictate your future. You have to decide, and you are the only one who can hold yourself accountable for that choice. To get a different result, we always have to do a different thing. Our next question today, these are all quite heavy duty, aren't they, is what do you do when someone assumes the worst about you? For example, if they say you're being rude, judgmental or negative, but that wasn't your intention at all. I think this happens quite often. If you say something quite neutrally or even kindly and the other person hears it through a completely different lens, suddenly you are seen to be judgy or rude or dismissive when none of that was in your mind at all. So where does that come from and what do we do? In my view, we all interpret the world through our own experiences and our own expectations. If someone's previously been criticized, dismissed, or spoken to harshly, they may be more sensitive to certain tones or phrases. They're not just hearing what you said, they're hearing what it reminds them of. So when they react, they're responding not really to you, but to their history. And this is important. If your intention was clean, you know, you were not being rude, unkind or dismissive, then the issue is not originating with you, it's arising in them. That can be uncomfortable, especially if you're someone who likes to keep things smooth and harmonious, like I do. It's very tempting to start questioning yourself. Should I have said that differently? Did I miss something? Have I upset them without realizing it? And of course, it's always wise to reflect. We need to be self-aware. If we've been careless or unkind, we should acknowledge it and fix it. But if you're clear within yourself that your intention was sound, then you do not need to take on what does not belong to you. You don't have to accept someone else's interpretation as your identity. Sometimes a simple response is enough. Oh, that was not my thinking. Or even, as I said to someone recently, I would never. And you just leave it there. Because if you continue to explain or justify or overcorrect, you can find yourself trying to solve something that's not yours to solve. Let's look a bit deeper at this. Our minds are constantly predicting and interpreting. Our brain fills in gaps based on past experience. If someone expects criticism, they're likely to perceive it, even when it's not there. Then your body follows and reacts as though something negative has occurred. You feel it. So from their perspective, the experience is genuine, but that does not make their interpretation accurate. And this is where we need a degree of steadiness. You can acknowledge their feeling without accepting their version of events. You can remain calm without collapsing into apology. You can be clear without being defensive. And importantly, you can allow them to hold their perception without making it yours. Not every misunderstanding needs to be resolved by you. Sometimes it's enough to know that you spoke from a good place. You can say, I'm sorry you saw it like that. That was not at all where I was coming from. Period. Because if you begin to carry every misinterpretation as your responsibility, you'll spend your life editing yourself to fit other people's histories. And that's not a good way to live. So the principle is simple. Check your intention. Be honest with yourself. Correct yourself if needed. But if your intention was clean, then stand in that. You do not have to take on a problem that was created by someone else's expectation. You can simply let it pass and remain as you are. Our next question is, Margot, what is your view on mixing friendship with business and money? People often say, don't work with friends or don't lend money to family. But is that really the best approach? The answer is yes and no. I don't really agree with that as a blanket approach. I think working with friends can be a great idea, provided you do it properly. If you already know someone's history, their character, their reliability, how they behave under pressure, that's valuable information. And in many ways, it can be more reassuring than entering into business with a stranger. Trust matters. But, and this is the important part, it's vital. Trust must be supported by structure. Friendship is not a substitute for clarity. If you're going into business with a friend, everything must be agreed in advance and put in writing. Not loosely or casually, properly, legally. Who's responsible for what? How does the money work? What happens if more money is needed? What happens if things don't work? What happens if one person wants out? What if that person is you? That's most important. What is your exit strategy? Agree this ahead of time, because that's when people come unstuck. When things are going well, nobody worries about leaving or thinks about it. But if circumstances change, and they often do, you must already have agreed how to unwind the arrangement or how to exit. Otherwise, you're no longer dealing with just a business issue. You're dealing with a business issue inside a friendship. And that becomes very complicated quickly. So yes, work with friends, but treat it as a business. Now let's talk about lending money, which is a slightly different situation. I think it's a lovely thing when families and friends are able to support each other by lending money. There's a generosity in that, and of course that has an important place. But you are not doing anyone a favour if you lend them money they are not able to repay. That's not kindness, that's creating a terrible pressure. If someone cannot realistically repay what you are lending, then the situation becomes strained. The relationship changes. There is a fallout on both sides. The borrower feels burdened and the lender feels resentful. Now, why do people not repay money? I think it's for three reasons. One, they forgot or overlooked it, which is easily corrected. Number two, they don't want to pay, which is a character issue. Or three, they cannot pay, which is a capacity issue. And that's where responsibility comes in. It's not enough to say, I lent them the money and now they can't pay me back. You, as the lender, must consider whether what you are offering is manageable for them. If it's a business they want the money for, and they are not a good business person, never lend them money. If you do, it's your fault. Are they in a position to repay? Do they have the discipline? Do they have the structure in their life to follow through? All these things must be considered. But if it's not a sound arrangement, then it won't work for either of you. So my preference in these situations is slightly different. Rather than lending money, I prefer a clean exchange. Instead of saying, I'll lend you this and hope that you can and will pay me back, say to them, I will buy something from you. It might be a car, a piece of furniture, something of value, a piece of jewelry, not necessarily equal in value, but something tangible. You give them money, they give you something in return. It's done. There's no lingering obligation, no ongoing pressure, no awkwardness. They are free to use the money as they choose. If they lose that money, that's in their court entirely. If you lend them something, you can possibly sell it back to them later if you both want that. So the principle is simple. Be generous, but be wise. Be trusting, but be structured. Be kind, but be clear. And in doing so, you protect both the relationship and yourself. On that note, this is where I invite you to send your questions in to us at admin@coastaccessradio.org.nz or to me under the contact tab at margotunlimited.com, Margot with a T. We're going to finish with our message from the universe, which of course, unsurprisingly, fits in with much of what we've talked about today. I received this just a few days ago. You must always go with your personal leading. If you don't feel it, don't do it. You must be finely tuned to me for this job you have ahead of you. It is your assignment. Do not allow others to influence you. It's you and me, remember? Feel your state just now. It is so good because of just that. You know we are working in sync. That is the key to all we are creating. Thank you and see you next time on Ask Margot.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.